offered it to his son, not to shake, but to take. As he'd reached out to his little boy when crossing the street, or in a crowd, or hiking along a trail when there was a rustle in the woods, to let Daniel know he was not alone. His father would protect him, no matter what. He would not lose him. "I'm not a child," snapped Daniel. "I don't need you. Never have. Never will." He turned his back on his father and left. Annie, Reine-Marie, Jean-Guy, and Severine got to their feet when Daniel appeared. "Everything's fine," he said. Though Reine-Marie wasn't fooled, she knew what fine meant. Armand came down a few minutes later. He'd needed the time to splash water on his face and gather himself. He stopped in to see Honoré and kissed the sleeping boy lightly on the forehead. As he went down the stairs, Armand heard Daniel say to his mother, "I'm sorry I didn't answer your call. I was with Stephen, didn't want to be disturbed." He turned to Severine Arbour. "Who are you?"
"I work with Jean-Guy."
She explained about Beauvoir coming to her home and asking for help. Armand came down and greeted her, thanking her for joining them.
"Let's sit at the dining table," he suggested.
As they walked over, Reine-Marie took his arm and whispered,
"Is she really here to help? You said they might try to place someone among us." "Her?"
"Possible," he whispered. "But Jean-Guy went to her, not the other way around."
"What are you two whispering about?" Annie asked.
"Food," said Reine-Marie. "What to order?"
"Oh, good. I'm starving."
The order was placed for sandwiches, patisseries, and drinks.
"There goes my other kidney," muttered Reine-Marie.
Armour also called down for an easel, paper, and magic markers. "In case you're still wondering," said Daniel, speaking to his mother and ignoring his father, "I did go to see Commander Fontaine. I told her that I knew Alexander Plesner, that he was a sort of mentor to me in the venture capital division."
"And what was her reaction?" Armour asked.
What had happened upstairs needed to be set aside. There were far more immediate, if not more important, issues to deal with. Daniel turned to him, and for a moment Armand thought he'd refuse to answer. She didn't seem surprised. His tone was brusque, but at least he replied.
"She probably knew already," said Armand. "Did she ask any questions?"
"She wanted to know what we invested in." "And?" said Jean-Guy. "We've only done one buy so far. A small company that needed capital to expand. Won't come to much. It's a trial run to work out any kinks in the division."
"What's the name of the company?" asked Jean-Guy, bringing out his pen and notebook.
"Screw you."
"Pardon?"
Jean-Guy looked up at Daniel.
"That's the name of the company."
When Daniel smiled, his entire face changed, as most people's did. "It was started by a couple of recent grads from the Polytechnic. Mechanical engineers. They thought it was funny. We think it's infantile. We're in the process of changing the name to Screw Up."
"That's better?" asked Annie.
"Well, less aggressive, more playful."
"Right," muttered his sister. "That's not infantile at all."
"What does it make?"
asked Reine-Marie.
"Screwdrivers."
"As in the tool?" Jean-Guy asked.
"Yes."
"Why that company?" asked Armand.
"Monsieur Plesner saw potential. It was his idea, not mine."
Daniel's answers to his father remained curt, though they were getting slightly longer.
"And nothing since?"
"No."
"Plesner didn't suggest anything else?" his father prodded.
"Well, we were looking at two other small companies, one that makes washers, those metal rings you put around a screw, and one that makes screws."
"Huh," said Jean-Guy. "That's interesting."
"Is it?" asked Annie. "Really?"
"Actually, yes. There were screws in Stephen's box. We thought they were from the desk upstairs, but maybe they were part of this venture capital research."
Armand turned to Severine Arbour.
"Does any of this sound familiar?"
She thought, then shook her head.
"I've never heard of the company, and never seen particular mention of screwdrivers in any of the documents.
They do mention screws, but we use a lot of those. And nails. And those washers you mention, but not screwdrivers.
Gamash nodded, but his thoughtful gaze lingered on her.
He's wondering how much I know, she thought, even as she wondered how much he really knew.
Armand turned to Daniel. We think Stephen was behind the venture capital you and Monsieur Plessner used to invest in that company.
No, you're wrong. It came from a fund. From different sources.
Those different sources were all Stephen. Mrs. McGillicuddy confirmed it.
Really?
Daniel's surprise was complete and genuine.
But why wouldn't he tell me?
To keep you safe, said Renmarie.
They explained about Stephen selling his art collection and about the buy orders Mrs. McGillicuddy had found, going back years. The investments Stephen was quietly making in diverse companies, and the huge funds transferred into his account with the Banque Privée des Affaires.
But why?
Asked Annie.
What's he doing?
We don't know. We hoped you could help, Armand said to Daniel.
Me? Said Daniel.
You don't think... Armand held up his hand. I believe you. But you know the markets. Know how these things work. What does this sound like to you?
Just then the concierge arrived and directed a worker to put up the easel and paper while Armand handed him an envelope.
Do you know which company Stephen was buying into? Daniel asked.
Here's what Mrs. McGillicuddy found.
Armand picked up a green magic marker and, consulting the email from Mrs. McGillicuddy, he wrote the names of the companies in large letters on one of the sheets of paper.
Anything look familiar?
Daniel was scratching his beard and leaning forward, eyes intense.
I've heard of some, but there doesn't seem to be any cohesion, any plan. And some are numbered companies. I can't tell from this what they might be doing and why, or if there's any connection.
It looks almost like a shotgun approach, said Annie. Like Stephen didn't really know what he was looking for and was covering as wide a field as possible.
Or hiding the one important buy among all the others, said Daniel.
That's what we wondered, said Renmarie.
Armand turned to Arbour, who was studying the list.
No, nothing, she said.
We need more information on these companies, he said, drawing a streak down the paper next to the names. Can you do that?
Yes, absolutely, said Daniel. I can go into the bank. Use my access to get information on the companies. The numbered companies will be more difficult, but I can try.
His father gave him a nod of approval, and Daniel felt something stir. What he saw now wasn't the man who'd made his mother cry. It wasn't even the fellow in the kitchen helping prepare meals, or playing with the grandkids in the garden, or sitting by the fire reading. What Daniel saw was a senior investigator with a clear mind and a quiet but complete authority. This was, Daniel thought, someone he could get behind. He had no beef with Chief Inspector Gamash. It was Dad he had the problem with.
Could Stephen have been going for a hostile takeover of GHS itself? Asked Annie.
No, said Daniel, his answer unequivocal. Even selling everything he owned, he'd never be able to raise enough. And a company that guarded would notice. He'd never get away with it. But if it looks like Stephen was involved in the venture capital, should I tell Commander Fontaine that? It might be important.
I suspect she already knows, said Armand.
But how? I didn't tell her.
Commander Fontaine would know, said Jean-Guy, because she might be involved.
What?
Demanded Daniel and Annie.
Severine Arbour raised her hands.
Wait, are you saying you think the Préfecture de Paris was responsible for the murder of Alexander Plessner?
Not the entire Préfecture, said Jean-Guy. But a select few, yes. It's possible.
That's ridiculous.
What makes you think they might be involved? Annie asked.
When your mother and father found Plessner's body in Stephen's apartment, said Jean-Guy, they interrupted someone.
Yes, I know.
What you don't know is that what alerted them was a scent, still hanging in the air,
a man's cologne.
It's a very unusual scent, said Renmarie. Claude Dussault, the prefect of police, wears it.
Oh, Annie moaned.
That can't be good.
And you suspect this Fontaine woman just because she's his second-in-command? Asked Madame Arbour.
Does that mean every time this guy screws up, I'm also to blame? Just because I'm his number two?
She waved toward Beaumois, who glared at her.
It's more than that, said Renmarie. We had the Dussaults over for dinner last night. Dr. Dussault told me that the cologne was a gift from his second-in-command after they'd been to a conference together in Germany. According to Claude's wife, Irene Fontaine bought some for herself, too.
So it could have been either of them in Stephen's apartment, said Daniel.
Yes, said Gamache.
Or neither, Madame Arbour pointed out.
True, admitted Gamache.
Or both, said Jean-Guy.
Daniel had gotten to his feet and was standing beside his father, examining the list of companies Stephen had, through Plessner, invested in. Armand watched him for a moment, knowing he'd have to drop another bombshell.
There's something else.
When we were at your place for the interview with Commander Fontaine, she wanted to talk privately. They were all listening, though it was clear that he was speaking directly to Daniel.
Yes?
She had a file on Stephen. Information collected at the end of the war. It questioned whether he really worked for the resistance or was a Nazi sympathizer, even a collaborator.
Come on, anyone who knows him would know that's ridiculous, said Daniel.
But most people don't know him, not personally. All they'd have to do is raise a suspicion and the damage is done, said his mother. We all know how easy it is to commit character assassination.
She glanced at her husband, the target of many such assassination attempts.
We think Stephen went to the company and told them, or hinted at, what he discovered, said Armand.
Demanded they stop whatever it is, and that he get to speak to the board.
Whatever it is, it's enough to ruin them. So they had to stop him.
They thought they could blackmail him into silence, said Renmarie. When that didn't work...
They all knew what happened next. What Daniel didn't know was why they were staring at him, all except Madame Arbour, who was looking out the window.
I was at the archives this morning to check into that old file, said Renmarie, her voice ominously gentle. According to their records, the dossier on Stephen was requested 5 weeks ago. By you.
What? Said Daniel, his face going an immediate and vibrant red. I never did that. Why would I do that? I didn't even know there were records on Stephen in the archives.
His voice had risen, loud and high.
We believe you, said Armand. Wait a minute, said Daniel, and they fell silent, allowing him to think it through. The Cop Fontaine had that file. She's the one who showed it to you, right? Is she the one setting me up? Did she put my name on the request, thinking you'd believe I was also involved?
She might have been the one who did that, said his father. But they'd know we'd never believe it, and we don't.
They're playing with us, showing us what they can do if they want. It's psychological warfare.
Jean-Guy turned to Annie. In legal jargon, that's called a mindfuck.
Yet more for Honoré's vocabulary, she said.
And Jean-Guy laughed. Daniel was pale.
They're predicting our every move.
Not all, said his father.
Just then the doorbell chimed. It was the food and drink. Plates of finger sandwiches, egg mayonnaise, coronation chicken, smoked salmon and cucumber were put on the table, along with tea cakes and scones, clotted cream and jams, and two large bowls of seasoned frites with mayonnaise. Armand signed for it and received an envelope from the waiter, which he opened, scanned, then placed in his pocket. As they helped themselves to the food and drink, Armand brought Stephen's agenda from his breast pocket and turned to the upcoming week. As he did, the scrap of paper he'd tucked into the flap fluttered to the ground. Séverine Arbour quickly stooped down and picked it up, beating Gamache to it.
though Beauvoir noticed he didn't really try, and wondered if that paper had really fallen by accident. AFP, she read as she placed it on the table.
Monsieur Horowitz's writing?
Yes, said Gamache.
Agence France-Presse?
Alexander Francis Plessner.
We think the dates are when Stephen and Plessner met. He made the same notation, AFP, in his agenda this past Friday, the day Plessner arrived in Paris. He handed the slip to Daniel.
Do the dates mean anything to you?
Daniel studied them and shook his head. They're not even in chronological order. They go from oldest to most recent, except that final one. It goes back 4 years.
Might mean nothing, said Armand,
tucking it back under the flap in the agenda. Now, the GHS engineering meeting tomorrow, he said, consulting Stephen's notes. Stephen's not on the board, so how would he get into the meeting?
He wouldn't, said Daniel. Couldn't.
And yet, said Gamache, that seems to have been his plan. So how would he do it? Daniel was shaking his head. No, it's impossible. He'd have to get a seat on the board.
And how would he do that? Asked Armand. There must be a way.
Daniel was staring into space, thinking. So like his father, thought Jean-Guy. He himself tried so hard to emulate Gamache, it seemed a shame, a waste, that someone who did it naturally didn't value it. Board members of corporations are often rewarded with perks, said Daniel, finally. Luxury trips to meetings, that sort of thing. And sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, they'd be enticed with shares in the company. Non-voting shares. So they'd never be able to band together and get control. But the shares would still be valuable enough to make them all wealthy.
And loyal, said Annie.
And blind, said Renmarie.
Hard to see wrongdoing over a pile of money.
So Stephen would have to buy shares off a board member?
Asked Jean-Guy. Yes.
Would they know?
Asked Renmarie.
Daniel thought about it.
The individual board member would have to know, but the chair of the board, the CEO, the majority owner, wouldn't necessarily. Not if the shares remained in the board member's name until the last minute.
That's interesting, said Armand.
According to Mrs. McGillicuddy, Stephen transferred a huge amount of money into his account at your bank a few weeks ago. It's unfrozen tomorrow morning.
Just before the board meeting, said Annie.
Daniel nodded a few times, his brows drawn together in concentration.
It's possible.
Why would someone agree to sell their shares and give up their seat?
Asked Severine Arbour.
Money, said Daniel. Why else? He'd offer to pay twice, 5 times, 10 times what the shares are worth.
Cash raised by, let's say, the sale of a priceless art collection, said Jean-Guy.
That sat on the gleaming table. They finally seemed to be getting somewhere.
There is, Daniel began, another reason a board member might sell.
What's that?
Asked Renmarie.
Stephen might have made it unbelievably attractive to sell, and unbelievably unattractive not to. A push-pull. Suppose he approached a member of the board and told them what he knew, what he was about to reveal. Something so compromising, it could not only bring about the collapse of the company, it would ruin anyone connected with it.
And within days, their shares would be worthless anyway, said Armand.
But how would Stephen know that person wouldn't go directly to Madame Roquebrune?
Asked Severine Arbour.
He'd have to know the board member personally, or have some information that would make him think this person would agree, said Daniel.
The devil you know.
Oui, said Armand.
Who's on the board?
Daniel grabbed the annual report and flipped to that section.
Holy shit.
What?
Demanded Annie.
Daniel passed it to his sister and looked at his parents.
Have you seen? Former presidents, prime ministers, emirs, generals. She's a former secretary general of the UN, and this one's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. 2 media moguls. It's a who's who. And all respected, or, well, mostly respected.
All with a great deal to lose if, as you said, it comes out that they've been propping up a corrupt conglomerate, said Armand.
Collaborators,
said Renmarie.
So, said Annie, which of them sold his or her stake in the company to Stephen?
We don't know that's what really happened, Gamache cautioned. There was silence. No answer was possible yet.
We have news too, said Beauvoir. Something I didn't tell you.
He turned to Annie. You're not going to like this.
When I left here a couple hours ago, I was pretty sure that man was back, watching us.
The secure fort guard? The one you chased last night?
Loisel, yes.
And you went after him again? Demanded Annie. Once was bad enough. You said yourself he's ex-special forces. He could have killed you.
But he didn't.
That's not the point,
she was shouting now, bawling up all her anger, all her fears, and hurling them at him.
Suppose he had. I can't imagine.
She stopped, unable to find the words.
What would we do without you?
She had both hands on her belly.
If something happened, what?
She dropped her head and started crying, sobbing. Her mother and father made to go to her, but stopped. It wasn't their role anymore. Jean-Guy was already there, kneeling down and holding her, whispering, I'm sorry, but I had to know what his orders were. To hurt you, the baby, Honoré, I had to stop him. I'm sorry.
You can't leave me, Annie whispered. I can't. This child. I can't raise her on my own. I need you.
You won't have to. I promise, I promise.
Annie and Jean-Guy left, returning more composed a few minutes later.
Okay,
Armand asked his daughter. When she nodded, he turned to Jean-Guy.
Annie's right. A younger Special Forces trained guard should have been able to take you. He'd take all of us, combined.
It was stupid, I admit, said Jean-Guy. The guy must have been told to intimidate me, but not to directly engage. When I confronted him, he disappeared.
Madame Arbour cocked her head. She knew that wasn't the truth. But at a look from Jean-Guy, she remained silent. Still, she wondered if she should say something. This was getting far too complicated.
That's when I went to see you, Jean-Guy said to her, to get some answers.
And what were the questions? Asked Armand.
Is GHS involved? And if so, what did Stephen find out that was so bad? Said Jean-Guy. I think now that's why he got me my job there. He knows my strengths aren't in business or engineering, but they are in criminal investigation, in noticing if something's off, and something is off in GHS. Unfortunately, he turned back to Madame Arbour, I thought it was you.
And I thought it was you. I mean, really? Why hire someone obviously unsuited to the job? Why put someone so absolutely incompetent in charge?
I wasn't so incompetent, said Beauvoir.
But at a stern look from Madame Arbour, he conceded the point.
Unless, she continued, because of his vast ignorance, he could be easily manipulated. Or, more likely, you were part of it, there to help them cover up. If you knew crime, presumably you'd also know how to hide it.
While we're at it, said Beauvoir, why put a competent engineer, brilliant engineer, in a department where there's no original engineering done? Unless the idea is that you're there to cover up, to make sure I didn't spot anything.
No fear of that, said Madame Arbour. You're perfectly capable of missing it without my help.
Their office Christmas parties must be fun, said Daniel to his mother.
I eventually realized my mistake, Jean-Guy admitted. You weren't covering up. You were digging for something, and I wanted to know what. That's why I went to your home this afternoon, to find out what you knew about the Luxembourg project. But you surprised me.
How?
Gamache asked.
Patagonia, said Arbour. I still think there's something off with Luxembourg, but like we talked about at the Eiffel Tower, I think Patagonia's the key.
The Eiffel Tower? Asked Annie. Why go there?
I needed some place where we wouldn't be overheard, said Jean-Guy.
It's perfect,
Armand agreed, though Renmarie noticed that just the mention of it had made him and Daniel pale. Now what about Patagonia?
Wait a minute,
said Madame Arbour,
putting up her hands and looking around. If we had to go all the way to the top of the tour to avoid listening devices, what's stopping someone from listening in now?
Nothing. I can almost guarantee they are, said Gamache.
What? Said Daniel. With all we've talked about? Are you kidding me?
They might not be, but we have to assume they are. There's no avoiding it.
Then shouldn't we be discussing the weather, or ice hockey, or whatever it is you Canadians talk about? Said Madame Arbour.
Gamache got up and walked to the floor-to-ceiling window. There may be bugs in the room, but more likely high-powered mics from one of the buildings nearby. He paused to gaze out, then turned to them. They've attacked Stephen, first with blackmail, and then they tried to kill him. They succeeded with Monsieur Plessner. They've set you up, Daniel. They've done everything they can, over the course of years, it seems, to cover up, to hide. I want them to know, he raised his voice slightly and turned back to the window, that they've failed. Then he dropped his voice and whispered, We're coming for you.
He'd leaned so close to the window that his words fogged up the glass, and on it he drew what looked like a snowflake before returning to his chair.
Let's continue.
They'll hear everything we say, said Annie, lowering her voice. They'll know what we know, and don't know.
Yes, but, Jean-Guy began. At that moment there was a bang, and the door to the suite blew open. While the others froze, Armand and Jean-Guy sprang to their feet.
Roslyn and the girls came in, laughing and talking. Then, seeing their faces, Roslyn stopped. Armand immediately lowered the knife he'd grabbed from the tray. A spoon clattered out of Jean-Guy's hand.
What's wrong? She asked.
Nothing, said Jean-Guy.
Nice, Rambo, said Annie, glancing at the spoon.
Yeah, well, look what you grabbed, Betty Crocker.
Annie looked at the scone, now crushed in her hands, and smiled.
Okay, said Roslyn uncertainly. We're just getting our coats. Sky's clearing, so we thought we'd walk over to the Arc de Triomphe.
Daniel got up, hugged them, and explained that it was probably best if they stayed in the suite. Roslyn was about to protest when she studied his face and nodded.
Come on, girls, grab your books. We'll go upstairs, lie on the bed and read.
It took some convincing and the promise of time on the iPad, but they finally agreed. Daniel took them up, then returned to the table.
You'd better be right, he said to his father. If you're wrong and anyone gets hurt...
He couldn't finish.
Yes. Armand turned back to Madame Arbour. Tell us what you know about GHS.
She looked frightened and unsure, and she was. Séverine Arbour was used to flowcharts and schematics, to things that made sense, or if they didn't, there was a method, a way to find the flaw and correct it. Engineers were problem solvers, but this was a problem she couldn't seem to solve, couldn't even see, not clearly. And it was getting muddier by the minute. She could feel the hysteria roiling up inside her. Composing herself, she took a deep breath and plunged on.
This all started.
Gamache's phone buzzed with an incoming text, and he dropped his eyes for a moment, then held up his hand.
Désolé. Just a moment.
He turned his phone around for all to see the message that had just arrived.
Can we meet? Fontaine de Mer, Place de la Concorde, 9 p.m.
It was from Claude Dussault. He typed, Oui.
Are you insane? Demanded Daniel.
Maybe, said his father, but without a smile.
He's listening,
said Annie, looking around, as though the prefect might appear from behind the sofa.
He knows we're getting close. That's why he wants to talk.
Instead of answering, Armand put a finger to his lips, and, getting up, he motioned them to follow.
Chapter 33 Armand took Annie and Jean-Guy aside. Lowering his voice, he said to his daughter,
You need to stay here.
No.
I'm sorry, but Honoré will be awake soon. And there's... He pointed to the unborn baby. Please.
Where are you going?
Not far, but I can't say.
She stared at her father, as serious as she'd ever seen him. Armand turned to Jean-Guy. Would you like to stay with Annie? He wanted to stay, to stand in front of her, and the baby, and Honoré. But he also wanted to stand beside Armand. And there were things only he knew, things he needed to tell them.
You need to go with them, Mombo, said Annie. We'll be safe. We have the cop. And no one's going to bother us with such a strong, handsome, manly man protecting us. I bet he has a huge gun.
Jean-Guy narrowed his eyes in mock concern.
Go,
Annie whispered, and gave him a long kiss as her father looked away. Outside the door, Jean-Guy spoke to the cop, letting him know that if anything happened to Annie and Honoré, to Roselyne and the girls, he would come for him.
Entendu, said the flic, and tightened his grip on his automatic rifle. Je comprends.
You'd better understand, said Jean-Guy, as Armand and Reine-Marie, Daniel and Séverine Arbour waited by the elevator. And you tell no one we've left.
Oui. I mean, non.
The ferocity of Jean-Guy's tone and expression had thrown the cop off a bit. Once in the elevator, Reine-Marie said quietly to Armand,
You're not really going to meet him, are you?
He took her hand and squeezed.
We'll talk.
But she had her answer. Jean-Guy stood in silence, watching the numbers drop. With each floor they passed, there was a chime, meant to be cheerful, but all it did was rattle him further.
You okay?
Armand asked as they sped past the main floor and kept going.
Oui.
Past the basement, past the sub-basement, and as they dropped, so did the colour from Jean-Guy's face.
You can go back up if you like.
No. When it could go no deeper, the elevator stopped. They stepped out, and Armand took an envelope from his pocket and removed a slip of paper and a key. Unlocking a door, he led them down a dim corridor, pausing once to consult the hand-drawn map. Then he headed this way, then that. Both sweaty and ice-cold, Jean-Guy followed. Adown titanic glooms of chasmed fears. A fine time, he thought, to remember that quote. But he finally understood what it meant. Pipes hissed as though serpents were passing overhead. The walls clanked and groaned. Finally, Armand stopped in front of a metal door. Consulting the map again, he unlocked it. When the lights came on, they could see stacks of broken equipment, vacuum cleaners, trolleys, crates.
How did you know?
Reine-Marie whispered. Closing the door and locking it, he held up the key and spoke in a normal voice.
Madame Bellon.
The general manager?
Asked Reine-Marie.
Oui. The waiter gave it to me when she brought up the food.
How did she know you wanted it?
Madame Arbour asked.
I sent a message down with the concierge.
That was the envelope you gave him?
Asked Reine-Marie.
Oui. I asked for the use of a room in the lowest level, where there were no cameras. I knew we'd eventually need a place where we couldn't be overheard or seen.
Daniel stared at this man, this stranger, who thought so many steps ahead, who found a corner of order in chaos. Was this really the same man who made scrambled eggs in his bathrobe on Sunday mornings?
Why didn't we come down sooner?
Daniel asked as they pulled crates into a circle.
Because we wanted them to overhear, said Jean-Guy.
You knew about the key? Asked Daniel. The plan to come here?
No, but I trust your father.
Daniel stared at Jean-Guy in open and undisguised amazement, even as his heart sank. What this man and his father had went so far beyond the bounds of camaraderie and friendship, beyond even blood. Daniel now knew he could never, ever compete. Once, maybe, but not now. It was far too late. He'd ceded his place to Jean-Guy Beauvoir.
Since they were listening anyway, said Armand, it made sense to have it work in our favour.
Tell them only what we wanted them to hear.
And not tell them everything we know, said Jean-Guy. Let them think we're further behind than we are.
Loiselle, said Madame Arbour, you didn't tell them the truth. I was wondering.
Thank you for not saying anything, said Jean-Guy.
Look,
I'm just trying to keep my head above water, she said. I have no idea what's going on.
Armand, from his crate across the circle, wondered if that was true. Another advantage of being down there was that while no message could get in, neither could messages be sent out. They were isolated, which was good. But they were also trapped, which was not. What's this about Loisel? He asked, but before Jean-Guy could answer, Renmarie touched his arm.
If the GHS meeting is tomorrow morning, wouldn't the board members be in Paris already?
Yes, probably. Why?
Where would they stay? Most don't live here.
Armand looked at his wife in wonderment. How had he missed that? A hotel, he said.
A luxury hotel, she said.
Jean-Guy's eyes opened wide. Is that why Stephen decided to stay in the Georges V instead of the Lutetia or another place? He knew that this is where the board members are being put up. I bet Stephen arranged to meet that board member here, said Daniel, to finalize his deal to buy the shares. When we leave, I need to speak to the general manager, said Armand.
I can go up right now and ask, Jean-Guy volunteered.
That's not a bad idea, said Armand, then narrowed his eyes. You will come back.
Maybe.
But he nodded as he took the key and map from Armand. Jean-Guy stared at the door, his way out, his way up, then offered the key and map to Renmarie.
You go.
The GM knows you and is more likely to tell you what we want to know.
You sure?
He looked anything but.
Oui.
Move quickly to the elevator, said Armand. If anyone stops you, shout and we'll come.
D'accord.
Just as she was about to leave, he quietly handed her his phone. Take this, he whispered. Messages will download on the surface. Renmarie slipped out. He closed the door only when it was obvious that she'd made it safely to the elevator. Okay now, he said, sitting back down on his crate and leaning toward Beauvoir. Loisel, what haven't you told us?
He was following me because he wanted to talk.
Talk, said Gamache. You mean threaten?
No, I mean talk.
What did he want to say? Asked Daniel. Jean-Guy told them everything, with Séverine Arbour jumping in now and then. And you believed him, said Gamache when they'd finished, that he wants to work with us now. Seems pretty abrupt. At that moment, there was a knock on the door.
Armand?
When he opened it, Renmarie quickly slipped through. As she hugged him, she slid his phone back into his pocket. That was fast. It didn't bode well.
Madame Bellon saw me right away. The board members aren't staying here, and the meeting isn't here either.
Damn, said Jean-Guy. It was such a good theory. But, said Armand, he could tell by Renmarie's bright eyes that there was more.
But Madame Bellon did know where they're staying. And where the meeting's being held.
Can you guess?
The Lutetia, said Jean-Guy.
Oui. They looked at each other and smiled. Yes, they were moving forward.
Renmarie was brought up to speed about Xavier Loisel and the Secure Fort operative's desire to switch sides and help them. She listened closely, shooting glances at her husband and remembering his prediction. That the next thing they'd do was get someone on the inside. And now there were two potential someones, Arbour and Loisel.
You believe him?
She asked, unknowingly repeating Armand's question.
Honestly, I've gone back and forth, but yes. Eventually I decided he probably meant it.
Probably? Asked Daniel. Is that good enough?
It's all we've got, so yes, it's pretty damn good.
Jean-Guy turned to Gamache. With Loisel on board and on the inside, we can finally make a plan.
Great, said Daniel. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
On seeing their expressions, he explained, Mike Tyson said that.
You're getting advice from Mike Tyson? Said Beauvoir.
And you're inviting someone who might be a killer to join us? What's worse?
At that moment, Jean-Guy was tempted to show Daniel what being punched in the face felt like. And yet, maddeningly, he recognized that Daniel and Mike might be right. Only the most disciplined, or the most stubborn, stuck to a plan when the first blow landed. The key was knowing when to adapt and when to hold firm. And he also recognized, somewhat grudgingly, that Daniel had a right to question. He had a lot at stake. Was Xavier Loisel an ally or a spy? Was he a member of their resistance or a collaborator?
You're right, said Jean-Guy to Daniel's surprise, but I think this is a risk we need to take.
He turned to Séverine Arbour. What was your impression of Loisel? She thought about it, then nodded.
I agree. I think he's sincere. He could have turned us in when we went to the office this afternoon, but he didn't. I think he's on our side.
Is that a certainty? She looked at Daniel.
No. As an engineer, I'm not at all comfortable with probabilities. The bridge will probably stay up. The plane will probably fly. No, we deal with as close to certainties as we can get. But life isn't a schematic. It's not an engineering project. Sometimes we need to take a risk, and sometimes, I guess, we need to be the one doing the punching.
Beauvoir nodded to Daniel, and Daniel, after a pause, nodded back. Did you say you went back to GHS engineering this afternoon? Asked Armand.
Yes, said Arbour. All three of us. Loisel pretended he was still tailing us.
Why did you do that? Asked Renmarie.
Isn't that like walking right into the rat's nest? We wanted to try to get into Carole Grosset's files, said Madame Arbour. She oversees both the Patagonia and Luxembourg projects. We thought we might find out what GHS engineering was really doing.
Armand sat forward. You mentioned Patagonia earlier. What's that about?
7 years ago, the regional governments realized that an abandoned mine was poisoning the drinking water of a town downriver, she explained. GHS Engineering was contracted by the Chilean government to build a water treatment plant, which they apparently did.
Apparently? Asked Renmarie.
According to what I was seeing coming across my desk, it was taking a very long time to build. Far too long. I wasn't suspicious of anything at first, except maybe government corruption, payoffs, the usual. Contractors prolonging construction to make more money. I did see that one of the first things GHS did before even beginning the project was to order a water sample taken and analysed so they know what was coming down from the mine.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Said Renmarie.
Yes. What didn't make sense is that the detailed results of that test were missing. What I did see was that GHS bought the mine and closed it.
But why buy it? Asked Daniel. If it was already abandoned and closed.
Exactly, said Madame Arbour. So I began to look closer. What really triggered my suspicions were the containers coming back from Chile. The documentation said they were equipment, but the weights didn't make sense, and the destinations didn't either. They cleared customs in record time, then the containers moved from site to site, eventually ending up in smelters. You don't melt down an excavator.
The mine had been reopened, said Jean-Guy. They were shipping back ore.
And hiding the fact, said Madame Arbour.
But why? What's in the mine? Asked Daniel. Gold?
Something even more precious.
Diamonds? He asked. And when Madame Arbour shook her head, he said, Uranium?
Madame Arbour held up her hand to stop the cavalcade of guesses.
Rare earth minerals.
Daniel leaned back on his crate. Wow. Are you sure?
Pretty sure. There was a mention, just in passing, in a report from a Chilean geologist, but it didn't say what sort.
What's a rare earth mineral? Asked Renmarie.
It sounds familiar.
The market went wild for them a few years ago, Daniel explained, when scientists realized what they could be used for.
Like? Asked Armand.
Séverine Arbour ran through some of the uses, everything from laptops to medical equipment, from nuclear reactors to airplanes.
And there are experiments with next-generation telecommunications, said Jean-Guy.
Shit, said Daniel.
If you could get in on the ground floor.
Yes, said Séverine Harbour, you could make a fortune.
The thing with rare earth minerals is that they tend to be far stronger than other minerals, last longer, are lighter, and easily adaptable. Versatile. Pretty much an engineer's dream.
What kind did they find? Daniel asked.
That's the problem, said Jean-Guy, and that's why we wanted to find the water test. We don't know.
So you don't know what it might be used for, said Armand.
Exactly, said Harbour. Is that what they're trying to cover up? Said Renmarie. Not that they found the minerals, but what they're doing with it. And that's what Stephen and Monsieur Plessner found out?
I think so, said Jean-Guy. But when we went to GHS, Loisel interrupted us.
But I thought, began Daniel.
He had no choice, explained Jean-Guy. Someone from Secure Fort was with him. Someone way up the chain. It was clever of Loisel to be there, too. He appeared to have informed on us, but I think he was playing the only hand he could, solidifying his position with his superior, while also protecting us. But there's something else. I recognized the Secure Fort officer, and so would you.
Me? Asked Gamache. Who was he?
That man we saw on the security tape here at the hotel, having tea with Claude Dussault and Eugénie Roquebrune.
Gamache absorbed that information quickly, then asked, Did he tell you his name?
Yes. Thierry Girard.
Jean-Guy Beauvoir wasn't prepared for Gamache's reaction. Rarely had he seen his former boss and mentor so surprised.
What is it? He asked.
Thierry Girard, Gamache asked. Are you sure?
Yes, said Madame Harbour. Why, do you know him?
Instead of answering, Gamache was quiet for a moment, thinking, slowly leaning back until he rested against the concrete wall. His hand went to his face, and his eyes narrowed in concentration.
Thierry Girard used to be Claude Dussault's second-in-command. He told us last night that Girard had left the prefecture for a job in private industry, but I didn't know it was with Secure Fort.
He looked at Beauvoir across the storeroom, as he had across so many rooms, across so many crimes, across so many corpses, across the years.
They were both meeting with Eugénie Roquebrune yesterday, said Jean-Guy. It looks like he's still Dussault's second-in-command, only now in Secure Fort.
His voice was gentle, knowing that Claude Dussault and Gamache went way back, and that his father-in-law considered Dussault a friend. Though evidence was now nearly overwhelming that that was no longer true. It looked like Claude Dussault had quietly taken over as head of Secure Fort, with Thierry Girard back as his loyal second-in-command, running the day-to-day operations of the private army, while Dussault remained at the head of the prefecture. His power, absolute. Had these two men, individually decent, somehow walked each other? Found, fed, magnified, justified the worst in each other? Until the unthinkable became acceptable, became normal.
Wait a minute, said Daniel. This Thierry Girard was the second-in-command at the Prefecture de Paris before Fontaine?
Oui, said his father. Irène Fontaine took over 18 months ago.
Armand turned back to Beauvoir and was about to speak when Daniel interrupted.
I was in Fontaine's office this afternoon. There are posters around, including one of Copenhagen Harbour. I commented on it, asked how she liked Copenhagen, but she said she'd never been outside France.
Beauvoir was about to ask what that had to do with anything, when he suddenly got it.
Cologne, he said.
Cologne, said Armand, nodding and smiling at his son.
Well done.
I don't understand, said Séverine Harbour.
Irène Fontaine couldn't have been the one who bought the cologne for Claude, said Armand.
Not if she'd never been outside France, said Daniel. When Monique Dussault told me that Claude's second-in-command gave him the cologne, said Renmarie, I assumed she meant Commander Fontaine. But actually she meant Thierry Girard, who also bought some for himself. Was he the one we interrupted in Stephen's apartment?
Perhaps, said Armand. They were getting closer to the truth,
but there was still far too much they didn't know. And time was short. It was now 5:45, just a few hours before he was to meet Dussault in the Place de la Concorde. Information would be his only ammunition, and so far he had precious little of that. He checked for the messages that had downloaded when Raine-Marie took his phone to the surface. Jean-Guy, the rational man who lived in a near-perpetual state of magical thinking, also checked his phone. Not surprisingly, it was empty of new messages. Armand's was not.
"What is it?"
Raine-Marie asked, noticing Armand's brows drop, then draw together.
"An update from Mrs. McGillicuddy. It looks like Stephen sold all his holdings."
"We know that," she said. "The fake art."
"No. All his holdings. Everything," said Armand. "All his shares, his investments, even in his own company. He's mortgaged his homes, liquidated everything."
"But that's not possible," said Daniel, moving to his father's side to read the message.
"He's in the hospital," said Raine-Marie. "How?"
"It says here he did it late Friday," said Daniel, scanning the message. "Minutes before market close."
"Mrs. McGillicuddy's just discovered it," said Armand. "This was no last-minute whim on Stephen's part. He's obviously spent years putting everything in place. This," he held up his phone, "was the coup de grace."
"That would come to,"
Daniel began. "Billions," said Armand.
"Wouldn't the markets react?"
asked Arbour. Daniel was shaking his head. He timed the sell orders so they wouldn't be noticed until the European markets opened tomorrow morning. By then they'd be unstoppable, and he'd have the weekend to do whatever else he needed.
"But what was that?"
asked Jean-Guy. "Does Mrs. McGillicuddy say?"
Armand shook his head. "She's as shocked as we are."
"Maybe he wasn't the one who sold it all. Maybe someone else did," said Raine-Marie. "Broke into his accounts and did it."
"No, it was Stephen. Mrs. McGillicuddy confirmed it before writing me."
Armand looked at Daniel.
"What do you think he's up to?"
Daniel returned to his crate and thought, finally shaking his head. "Buying his way onto the board would take maybe 100 million, maybe more, not billions. He had something else in mind, but what? It looks like he's going all in on something. If there's a sell order, was there also a buy order?"
"Mrs. McGillicuddy's looking. Is it possible to put in a buy order late on Friday?" asked Armand. "To be executed first thing Monday?"
"Yes, for sure. But there'd still be a record, somewhere. We might be able to track it down," said Daniel, considering. "If I go to the bank, I can at least see if the money is still in his account, and if not, I might be able to trace where it's gone. I can also look into those numbered companies he and Monsieur Plessner were buying into."
Armand brought out his wallet, and without hesitation gave the tattered old JSPS card to his son.
"This might help."
Raine-Marie watched Daniel put it in his jacket pocket, and she wondered if he understood the magnitude of what his father had just done. Armand did not particularly value possessions, but there were two that he held precious. One was his wedding ring. The other was that small card, which he hadn't been parted from in half a century.
"We need to find out which board member, if any, Stephen approached," said Armand.
"That's something I can look into," said Raine-Marie. "Research the members. See who might be the most vulnerable. I'll call Madame Lenoir from the hotel reception and see if we can use the terminals at the Archives Nationales." "I'll go with you," said Séverine Arbour. "I can help."
"No," said Armand. "Jean-Guy, can you go with Raine-Marie?"
"Absolument."
"You come with me," he said to Arbour. "I think we can rattle them a bit more."
"How?"
she asked. "By going to the Hotel Lutetia."
"A punch in the face?" asked Jean-Guy.
"Let's start with a tap on the shoulder," said Gamache with a smile. "Sometimes more frightening. Besides," he turned to Madame Arbour, "I need more information from you about the Patagonia and Luxembourg projects before I see Claude Dussault."
"You're still going to meet him?"
asked Raine-Marie. "Unless something changes, yes. If Claude wants to talk,
I want to listen.
What if he wants to do more than talk?
She asked, trying to keep her tone casual, but the stress was obvious.
Then he wouldn't have chosen such a public place, said Armand. A side street, a private home, I'd be worried. But Place de la Concorde, it's far too public to do anything other than stroll and talk.
He held her eyes.
Believe me.
Renmarie nodded. She believed him. She trusted him. It was Claude Dussault she didn't trust.
Jean-Guy,
she said, turning to her son-in-law. I agree. It's safe. I think Dussault wants to see how much we know without revealing his own position. They're worried. Armand handed Renmarie the scrap of paper from Stephen's agenda after first taking a photo of it.
You might look up those dates, too. See if anything significant happened.
He got to his feet.
We need to go up.
So soon?
Asked Jean-Guy.
Chapter 34
Monsieur Beauvoir?
Asked the concierge, crossing the lobby of the Grand Hotel.
Oui?
Up from that crypt, Jean-Guy was breathing in the sweet scent of the fresh flowers in the lobby and almost tearing up at the sight of the fading daylight beyond the doors of the Georges V.
A man dropped this off for you?
She handed him an envelope. Beauvoir opened it. On the slip of paper was written one word, neodymium, and below that the letters XL. He showed it to the others.
What does this mean?
They crowded around.
Neodymium is a rare earth element, said Séverine Arbour.
Extra large? Asked Daniel.
Oh, right, it's...
But a look from his father stopped him. The message was from Xavier Loisel. He'd managed to get into Carol Gossett's files and find the water sample results.
So he is on our side, said Renmarie.
Though it looked like it, Armand wasn't totally convinced. He'd used agents to infiltrate organizations, and part of the technique of a spy was to hand over legitimate information as proof they could be trusted. What he did think was that this information, at least, was correct. GHS Engineering had discovered neodymium in the abandoned mine.
What's it used for? He asked Madame Arbour.
Magnets.
Magnets? Repeated Jean-Guy.
Fridge magnets.
The engineer stared at him.
Yes, said Madame Arbour. People are being murdered in an epic battle for control of the fridge magnet empire. Look, magnets are used in all sorts of things, not just to stick hockey logos on your fridge.
A simple no, said Beauvoir. Though it was true, he had several Montreal Canadiens up there.
What else are they used for? He asked. Computers, I think, she said. But there must be a lot of other things. I'm no expert.
We need to find out more about this neodymium, said Armand.
Shouldn't be hard.
Séverine pulled out her phone.
No, he said. We need someplace more private.
Then I can go to the archives.
Jean-Guy glanced at her. This was the second time she'd suggested that. Why was she so determined to go there? And why was Gamache so determined she should not?
He thought he knew why.
If Madame Arbour was an infiltrator, she must not be there when they found out which board member sold their spot to Stephen. They were close, so close, they couldn't take any chances.
No, Gamache said to Madame Arbour, I need you with me at the Lutetia, if you don't mind.
There was, as always, courtesy in his words, but their meaning was clear.
Ali de Lenoir hung up the phone and turned to her wife. Back to the mines?
Far from a derogatory way to describe her work, the head archivist considered the miles and miles of files a gold mine, filled with treasures, with adventure, the unknown waiting to be unearthed.
I'm coming with you, said Judith de Lagrange.
As the chief librarian for France, Judith de Lagrange knew, better than most, that the documents contained in the glorious old buildings were both fascinating and dangerous. And this night had the makings of both. 10 minutes later, they were greeting Renmarie at the main gate.
Hope you don't mind my bringing Judith along,
said Madame Lenoir.
Gardner,
said Renmarie. The chief librarian was legendary in Renmarie's universe. From an old aristocratic family, Judith de Lagrange's ancestors had owned, almost a millennium ago, the original chateau where the archives and museum now stood. Slight, fine-boned, she radiated a fierce energy and intelligence, a lioness stuffed into a gerbil's body.
I hope you don't mind my bringing my son-in-law, said Renmarie, introducing Jean-Guy.
Renmarie explained that while he now worked in private industry in Paris, Jean-Guy had been a senior officer in homicide in the Sûreté du Québec. As they made their way to the reading room, Renmarie followed Jean-Guy's eyes out the window and saw what he was staring at.
A dark spot against the sunset, like an astigmatism in the eye.
A drone. The Banque Privée des Affaires, for security reasons since the recent terrorist attacks, did not encourage weekend visitors. And the guard was more than a little suspicious of a junior executive who urgently needed to get in at 7 on a Sunday evening. Even when, especially when, Daniel produced the JSPS card. The guard looked at the card, then made a call.
Can you come to the front desk, please, Petrol? There's someone here who has an ID in the name of Daniel Gamache,
but he just gave me a card with someone else's name. Yes, it is suspicious.
No, Daniel began, then stopped when the guard put his hand up for him to be quiet. A door opened and the supervisor came out. Not saying a word, he studied Daniel, then turned his attention to the card on the counter in front of the guard. Picking it up, he looked at Daniel more closely, then, to the guard's amazement, said,
Come with me.
Séverine Arbour went over to the statue of Gustave Eiffel at the entrance to the Lutetia and was admiring this hero of France, a giant among engineers and innovators, a man of vision, of courage, and of brute ambition. While she studied the face of the great engineer, Gamache studied the faces of the hotel guests to see if he recognized any from the annual reports. Renmarie had been right, of course. This was a rat's nest. At least one, probably more, of the people under that roof had been involved in the murder of Alexander Francis Plessner and the attack on Stephen. They'd threatened, hounded, pursued, chased his family from their homes, all in an effort to make them go away. And he wanted them to know it had not worked. Far from going away, he'd come to them, for them. Madame Arbour, he said. And together they walked down the long corridor, their footsteps echoing off the marble surfaces. At Bar Josephine, they found a table against the wall and ordered drinks. While Madame Arbour took a long sip of her red wine, Armand simply swirled his scotch, then put it back on the table. "Recognize anyone?" he asked. She looked around at the other patrons, well-heeled, well-dressed, mostly white, mostly French, mostly older. They looked like them. No. But Gamache did. Over there, in a quiet corner, was the former head of the UN Security Council. She now sat on the GHS Engineering Board. Joining her was another member of that board. And there in the centre of the room, holding court, was the head of a media conglomerate who also sat on the GHS board. Loud and laughing, corpulent and confident, the man commanded attention. Gamache continued to study the room. He'd become, through practice and necessity, very good at faces. He recognized most of the members of the board from news reports over the years and their photographs in the annual report. He suspected some, if not most, would have no idea that anything untoward was going on. They'd been flown to Paris on private jets, put up in a luxury hotel, were being pampered in advance of an annual rubber-stamp board meeting. But some would know what was really happening. The question was, which ones? And which one had Stephen approached with a sackful of money? As he looked around, not trying to conceal his interest, a few caught his eye and paused, returning the stare of the distinguished stranger, before turning away. Yes, Some in that room definitely knew what was going on. He just wished he was one of them.
"I've never been to this hotel," Séverine Arbour was saying. "I'd have expected it to feel different. Not so inviting."
"Why do you say that?"
"Well, isn't this where the Nazi interrogations happened?"
She fixed him with a hard gaze.
"Seems appropriate."
He raised his brows. "You think you're here for an interrogation?"
"Aren't I? Not torture. You're far too civilized for that. But you are trying to work out whose side I'm on. Isn't that right?"
Armand smiled and tilted his head slightly. She was smart, clever. He'd have to be even more careful than he'd thought. "My job has made me suspicious," he admitted. "But it's also taught me not to prejudge. I am curious that, by your own admission, you began to suspect something months ago, but hadn't yet found the results of the water test. Something this Xavier Loisel found in minutes."
"I wasn't initially looking in that direction," said Madame Arbour. "As I told you, at first I thought it was something to do with building the plant. Contractors dragging it out. It's only recently that I realized the issue isn't the plant, but the mine."
Gamache nodded and opened his hands.
"That explains it, then."
"Listen," she dropped her voice.
"Beauvoir came to me, remember? Practically dragged me from my home. Believe me, I'd much rather be in my living room drinking wine and watching reruns of Call My Agent. I'm an engineer, not," she waved her hands and looked around, "whatever this is."
"Then why did you agree to help?"
"Honestly? If I'd known it was this bad, I'd never have answered the door. I was curious. I thought GHS was involved in some scam. Not," she dropped her voice still further,
"murder." She was certainly stressed, afraid. Perhaps because she knew her people were also in Bar-Josephine, watching, listening, and she knew what they were capable of. Or perhaps because she'd woken up in her nice bed, in a nice neighborhood of Paris, expecting a nice, quiet Sunday, and had instead been swept up to the top of the Eiffel Tower, then down into the bowels of the Georges V, swept into another world, one where people killed other people, for reasons as yet obscure. And now, instead of letting her go with the others to the relative safety of the Archives Nationales, he'd brought her here, exposing her to the very people she'd been trying so hard to avoid. All good reasons to be afraid. But was she afraid of them or him?
"Well, I am used to this." He didn't bother to drop his voice. "It's what I've done. All day, every day, for decades. You find problems and solve them. I also find problems and solve them. It's what we both do best."
"Yeah, well, your problems kill people."
"So do yours, I expect."
His thoughtful eyes held hers, and then he did drop his voice.
"You're doing fine."
She lowered her eyes to her wine and took a deep breath in, a deep breath out. This was making less and less sense, and she wondered if she should tell him
everything.
"Now," he said, his voice at a normal level again,
"neodymium."
She hesitated for a moment, clearly considering her options. If she got up and walked out, he couldn't stop her. But Madame Arbour was smart enough to know there were no options left. She had to see this through.
"All I have is my phone," she said. "Should I look it up? Suppose they've hacked it. That's what you're worried about, isn't it? And aren't they listening now?" She looked around.
"Probably. Don't worry about your phone. If it's all we have, then we have to use it."
"You want them to know, don't you?"
It was a statement, not a question.
"I see no way around it." Time they felt our warm breath on the back of their necks.
"If we're that close to them," she said, bringing out her phone, "aren't they that close to us?"
"Yes, but they always were. What's changed is our position, not theirs. And they know it. What do you have?"
He put his reading glasses on and leaned close. She'd entered the name of the rare earth element into a specialized site for engineers, and up popped the information.
"Nothing,"
said Jean-Guy, throwing himself onto the back of the chair and staring at the screen. They'd